Jamastu Maduchanda. Maduchanda Saevate. Vishvamitrasya Chaivasan. Putra Eka Shatam Nripa. Majjamastu Maduchanda. Maduchanda Saevate. Vishvamitrasya Chaivasan. Putra Eka Shatam Nripa. Majjamastu Maduchanda. Maduchanda Saevate. Ladies. Shamitra Shachayavasa. Vishvamitra Shah. Vishvamitra. Cha. Also. Eva. Indeed. Asan, there were. Putra, sons. Ekashatam, 101. Nripa, O King Pariket. Majjhima, the middle one. Two, indeed. Maduchanda, known as Maduchanda. Maduchandasa, named the Maduchandas. Eva, indeed. Te, all of them. Translation purport by Srila Prabhupada. O King Pariket, Vishvamitra had 101 sons, of whom the middle one was known as Maduchanda. In relation to him, all the other sons were celebrated as the Maduchandas. Purport. In this connection, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur quotes the statement from the Vedas. Dashaha Vishvamitra Shaika Shatam Putra Asu Pashanat Eva Jayamso Maduchandasa Panchashat Kanyamsa. Vishvamitra had 101 sons, 50 were older than Maduchanda, and 50 were younger. Text 30, translation. Vishvamitra accepted the son of Ajigarta, known as Shunashepa, who was born in the Bhrigu dynasty and was also known as Devarata, as one of his own sons. Vishvamitra ordered his other sons to accept Shunashepa as their older brother. 1931. Shunashepa's father sold Shunashepa to be sacrificed as a man-animal in the Jagya of King Harishchandra. When Shunashepa was brought into the sacrificial arena, he prayed to the demigods for release and was released by their mercy. Report. Here is a description of Shunashepa. When Harishchandra was to sacrifice his son Rohita, Rohita arranged to save his own life by purchasing Shunashepa from Shunashepa's father to be sacrificed in the Jagya. Shunashepa was sold to Maharaj Harishchandra because he was the middle son between the oldest and the youngest. It appears that the sacrifice of a man as an animal in Jagya had been practiced for a very long time. More interesting facts from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Om Gyana Timurandasha Gananjana Salakaya Chakshun Mutamina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Anchakal Patrivischa Klevis Sindhu Vivacha Patitano Pavane Bio Vaishnavi Vimu Namaha. So we're beginning the story of Vishvamitra and his descendants. We've sort of segued from Lord Parashuram and then moved into the next narration here. Actually, yesterday's verse began this, and we didn't really discuss it much because it was the appearance of David Waitacharya, so we just read the verse without really commentary. So I think I'll also refer to that purport, and because it sort of sets the scene here. The verse 4, text 28, was Vishvamitra, the son of Maharaj Gadi, was as powerful as the flames of fire. From the position of a Kshatriya, he achieved the position of a powerful Brahmin by undergoing penances and austerities. So this is the story of Vishvamitra and his descendants. And Vishvamitra is kind of a rather interesting story in that he began life as a Kshatriya and then became a Brahmin. So it's described that in this purport that there are several instances of this. For instance, Parashurama was a Brahmin who acted as a Kshatriya. Although he was born in a Brahmin family because of the necessity for protecting the world from the Kshatriyas, he assumed the role of a Kshatriya, and then after that he reassumed his position as a Brahmin after that work was done. Similarly, Vishvamitra was born in a Kshatriya family, was a very powerful Kshatriya king actually, and then but he became a Brahmin for a not altogether good reason, a somewhat selfish reason, really just to gain more power. So there's many instructive stories here. We see as many examples in the Srimad Bhagavatam of what the great saints, sages, great devotees did and the activities they performed that we emulate, but we also see some negative examples of people who had great power or had great ability or had great fame or wealth or strength, but often misused that, or used it in such a way that was really more for their own material gain than for the good of the people. So the story of Vishvamitra, rather interesting, he actually has a long-standing relationship with Vishishta Muni. We often see Vishvamitra and Vishishta together in different pastimes. They're usually not, it's not a very good relationship, though. In fact, they tend to be there's a lot of enmity between them, and there's a lot of difficulty throughout many, many years of the relationship. So that relationship began when Vishvamitra was a great king, and he had these 100 sons, and he came upon the place of Vishishta Muni, who was a great sage meditating, and Vishishta Muni had this very, very powerful mystic cow, just somewhat like we read about Janmadagni's Sarabi cow, who was able to give anything that was wanted. He had a similar cow, but this cow had actually great powers. And Vishvamitra wanted that cow. And because he wanted it and he was the king, he felt he had the right to take whatever he wanted. So he simply stole the cow. He took the cow. And then the cow prayed to its master, Vishishta. He says, "Why are you allowing this to happen to me? What have I done to offend you?" And Vishishta said, "You've done nothing, but somehow he had some plan. He didn't want to directly attack the king. So he somehow arranged that basically this cow had these incredible mystic powers, released all of his tremendous arms against Vishvamitra Muni and defeated him. And actually, there was such power here, of course, coming from the power of Vishishta Muni, that he killed the 100 sons that we hear about here in this verse were all killed by Vishishta. So he was completely defeated, very much discouraged, but that didn't stop him, of course. He decided, now I need to get more power. So he did a great sacrifice. He finally appeased Lord Shiva. And when Lord Shiva asked him what he wanted, he said he wanted all of the weapons, all the astras, all these great, you know, weapons that all the demigods had, so he'd be undefeatable. So Lord Shiva gives him a benediction, this boon of having all of these weapons. So he then attacks, he goes back and attacks Vasishtha again. And Vasishtha, simply by holding his staff with his Brahma Tejas, his great brahminical power, he absorbed every single weapon that Vishwamitra could throw at him, and was wholly uninjured. In fact, then sort of shot them back at him. Anyway, Vishwamitra was thoroughly defeated once again. So he realized that the no matter how much power of arms he had, he could not defeat the power of the Brahmin, because the Brahmin's power was actually spiritual. Not simply a matter of material might, you know, that he had, they had this greater power. So, being quite a stubborn personality, he decided, I'll become a Brahmin then, and I'll have even more power. So he didn't exactly learn the lesson, but he did. He did great austerities again and finally became a Brahmin. And so Vishwamitra and Vasishtha Muni sort of continued this relationship over the course of many, many years and kalpas. And there was a lot of different stories, which we won't get into now, which involved cursing and counter-cursing, and one cursed the other to be a bird, and then the other one cursed him to become a duck, and things like that. So they, somebody had to finally release them from the bird life. I forget how that story went. But this was the sort of thing that was going on between them. So we can see that that Vishwamitra certainly had a few not quite so... good qualities. Of course, he does become a great sage, and he does figure into many of the pastimes that we hear in the Srimad Bhagavatam, but he didn't have too good of a start in his brahminical life. So one of the main point of the previous purport and some of these verses that we're seeing is that one's spiritual position is not dependent upon their material circumstance or even their circumstance within Varnashram Dharma. One may be a Brahmin, one may be a Kshatriya, but this is not really so essential, because we understand that that one's position is actually dependent upon one's quality and one's work, not by one's birth. So being born in a family of Brahmins or being born in a family of Kshatriya is not necessarily a qualification. But as the Bhagavad Gita says, it's due to guna and karma, one's qualities of work and one's activities. So this is what really determines one's position, not simply by birthright. We had some very nice examples yesterday on Advaitacharya's appearance day of how Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu continued and really emphasized this position, that the position of a Vaishnava is not dependent upon one's material situation or how, where one is born or what class or caste or country that one is born in. And of course, Advaitacharya set that great example by his friendship with Haridas and honoring of Haridas Thakur. And we also see, of course, that Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, who were under the employment of the Muslims and were considered outside the Brahminical culture, they became the greatest followers and devotees of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And we can see so many different examples like this. And the thing that we learn from this is that the position of a devotee of the Lord, of a Vaishnava, is really beyond any of these material designations. There was a nice example that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati gave us, and we have that story of how he very powerfully helped to defeat Smarta Brahmanism, which was very, very prevalent during the time when he began his preaching, that so many of the even so-called Vaishnavas were very caste conscious, very conscious of whether what birth one took, what family one was in. I'll just read just a paragraph or two. It's a story from the biography of Bhaktisiddhanta. And talks about this famous speech that he gave in 1911, where he sort of took on the Brahminical caste. It says, initially he began to recite the glories of the Brahmins. The opposing pandits were beside themselves with joy. They had no idea that there were so many verses glorifying Brahmins. and they eagerly heard Siddhanta Saraswati speak. However, Siddhanta Saraswati then began to explain and define the Brahman, the Vaishnava, and the relationship between the two, the qualifications of a guru, etc. And then the opposition's joy quickly subsided. When no one could offer a strong argument in response, a huge uproar commenced. Some counter-arguments were given, but Siddhanta Saraswati immediately refuted their contentions with searing logic. The meeting went on this way for 3 days. The Vaishnavas all offered strong arguments that no matter what a family a Vaishnava appears in, he is perfectly qualified to worship the Shalagram Shila and to recite the Vedas. On the final day, Siddhanta Saraswati was the concluding speaker. He spoke brilliantly with great vigor and incredible rhetoric for 2 hours. When he finished, no one on the opposing party could say a word. There was simply no way to counter him. There was a huge uproar and acclaim of the brilliant Acharya. Thousands of people rushed forward to take the dust of his lotus feet. So this was really the beginning of the ascendancy of Vaishnavism in Bengal and, of course, West Bengal and throughout India. At Bhaktisiddhanta, following the footsteps of the foundations that his father, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, had set, really began the strong preaching of Vaishnavism and establishing Vaishnavism philosophically as a very, very powerful philosophy, a very powerful practice, you know, that was beyond the sort of mundane rules and regulations and the different injunctions that were there according to the Brahminical so-called culture of the time. So this also leads to the question of the system of Varnashram. Here we are seeing that while Varnashram is needed, in fact, Prabhupada says at the end of that purport that if there are discrepancies in Varnashram society, human society will turn to the society of animals, and the situation all over the world will be hellish. So there needs to be this regulation of society. At the same time, we understand that this is somewhat of a material arrangement for the organization of society, and does not really go to the deep heart of one's spiritual life and spiritual consciousness. This was brought out in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya to Ramananda Roy. Of course, Lord Chaitanya asked Ramananda Roy to speak to him the highest truth, what was really important in life, and what one should understand about spiritual truth. So Ramananda Roy tried a number of different propositions. And he began, one of his beginning ones was talking about Varnashram. So he quoted this verse from the Vishnu Purana, says, "The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, is worshipped by the proper execution of prescribed duties in the system of Varnashram. There is no other way to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One must be situated in instruction, institution of the four Varnas and Ashrams." Well, this sounds very good. Sounds very logical. Lord Chaitanya rejected that. He said, this is external. He says, tell me something more. Go beyond this. So, why is that? It is external because it has to do with the organization of the society within this material world. It is not really an eternal principle of spiritual life. It is necessary for proper organization so that society can remain peaceful and have a very, very good foundation for Krishna consciousness. But it does not ensure Krishna consciousness in itself. Srila Prabhupada explained this in the purport. This is to 860. Prabhupada said, as long as one is in the material world, he must follow the principles of Varnashram Dharma. But devotional service is transcendental. The system of Varnashram Dharma refers to the three modes of material nature. But transcendental devotional service is on the absolute platform. So this is an important understanding, that certain things may be necessary while we're in this material world, but ultimately the idea is to transcend everything that is connected with the three modes of nature. So the real value of Varnashram is connecting to the devotional service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And without that connection to Krishna, then all of our duties, all of our different activities have almost no value. Of course, the verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam 1:28 says, dharmaksvan sanushtita pungsam dishpakshena katasuya nupadayed yadiritim shramaheva hi kevalam. The occupational activities of a man performs according to his own position are only so much useless labor if they do not provoke attraction for the message of the personality of Godhead. So this is really the essence, and of course Lord Chaitanya rejected all of the statements of Ramananda Roy up until the point of pure devotional service. It is really only the platform of pure bhakti, of devotional service, that was recognized by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as being really worthy or really being relevant. You know, because if pure devotional service is not the end of one's activities, as described here, if those activities do not develop rati, or attraction for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Bhagavatam says those are so much useless labor. So the point is that we want to develop our loving relationship with Krishna. And whatever we do is aimed at developing that relationship with Krishna. The activities themselves are only valuable when they are in connection, when they connect us with Krishna. So, in many ways, our acharyas, including Srila Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta and the others that we've seen, rejected many aspects of traditional, what might be called Vedic culture, or let's say at least Indian or Hindu culture at the time. It may not have been actual Vedic culture. And certainly rejected many aspects of Varnashram. And we can see that that Srila Prabhupada was much more interested in establishing the culture of Sankirtan Jagya, of the spreading of the holy name, rather than a particular imposition of Indian or Hindu culture into the Western world. But at the same time, that does not mean that we are devoid of culture. Srila Prabhupada was interested in spreading Vaishnava culture. And I think that's where we need to make a distinction and have an understanding. You know, while we may reject some of the external or material superficial aspects of what we were calling Varnashram or Vedic culture, we are not rejecting what is true Vaishnava culture. And we have to be careful about that, that we now don't think that, well, you know, none of these things are relevant, we just chant Hare Krishna and do anything else we want. While it is true there are no hard and fast rules for the chanting of the holy name, there are certainly rules and regulations that guide the activities and the behavior of a Vaishnava. And particularly in the beginning stage of Vaidhi Bhakti, it's very important that one does follow the rules and regulations of devotional service under the direction of the spiritual master. And we need to be very clear on that. When we say the beginning stages, I think most of us could certainly say that, you know, we are in those beginning stages. It is not that we suddenly have jumped to some position of, great transcendence or, some superior position where those things no longer apply to us. And even if that is true for some of you, still, you will follow those rules and regulations to set a good example for the rest of us. So that's generally the position of the Vaishnavas. We know that we saw the example of the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, who were the most exalted devotees probably ever on this planet, you know, at least in a few yugas. And we have, you know, such tremendous examples of people who are on the highest level of Krishna Prema, of Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, but their activities were very much following the principles of Vaishnavism, very much following the principles of chanting. It's even described in the prayers of the six Goswamis that they chanted regulated rounds, that they were performing everything according to the rules and regulations. Why? Not because they particularly needed to, but because they are setting example. And the other aspect is, if you actually look at the principles of sadhana bhakti, they really consist of hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord. So our principles are nine practices of devotional service, hearing, chanting, and remembering. These, while they are part of our sadhana, they are part of our regulated practice to purify ourselves, they are also the practices of one who is completely pure. In other words, before we are purified or liberated, we are chanting Hare Krishna, and after liberation or after reaching a level of transcendence, we are also chanting Hare Krishna. So these are completely pure activities. These are absolute activities of the spiritual world. So which is another reason why the devotee, no matter what stage he reaches in his devotional practice or his adhikari, his particular situation or qualification, they are still, because of spontaneous attraction, chanting the holy names of the Lord. So this is what we see. We see that Srila Prabhupada was always chanting Hare Krishna. He was always chanting on his beads or chanting in his mind, or even sometimes when he was talking, having conversations, he was sometimes chanting in the background. So it's not something that the pure devotee gives up. It is not something that we do until we reach a higher platform, and then we're able to, I don't know, do what? You know, in other words, what is the higher platform beyond the practices of hearing and chanting? There is no higher platform, because as I said, these are the practices of the spiritual world. And the gopis may not be chanting japa, but they're chanting the glories of Krishna day and night. They're constantly glorifying the Lord, constantly remembering Krishna, constantly hearing about Krishna. So the hearing, chanting, remembering is going on eternally in the spiritual world. So our practices of sadhana are actually those same practices that are suitable for us and given to us by the spiritual master, of how we in these material bodies in the Kali Yuga, in this particular time and circumstance, how we can advance in Krishna consciousness. So, Srila Prabhupada, of course, started very liberally, and he simply wanted everyone to come and chant Hare Krishna, and little by little he told us some of the other rules and regulations, and gave us a little bit more discipline in our life, added the regular principles, etc., etc., which in the beginning the devotees really weren't so aware of. And so this continued for some time, and we learned more and more about the practice of Krishna consciousness and really how to conduct ourselves as Vaishnavas. And this is a very significant change in most of our lives. For some of you come from more from that culture. But for many of us, this was a complete cultural shift, a complete change in our lives, learning to do things and learning behaviors and attitudes and conduct and a consciousness. It was very, very different. And of course, we found that it was a very wonderful culture and consciousness to develop. Now, sometimes we see as years go by and the movement is expanding and more people are attracted to Krishna consciousness, and many, many different types of people will become attracted. And people will come at all different levels. And people who are, you know, more or less ready to follow strict rules and regulations. Of course, Srila Prabhupada, not to completely reject Varnashram Dharma, Srila Prabhupada did say he wanted to create a class of Brahmins. In other words, people who were knowledgeable in Krishna conscious philosophy who could help lead the world. So that is very important. And that is needed. It is needed for all of us as followers of Srila Prabhupada, you know, to understand this philosophy of Krishna consciousness and become competent and capable to preach this philosophy to others. But at the same time, some of those others who are coming will not necessarily be at that same situation. And therefore, there needs to be many, many ways to engage people in Krishna consciousness according to their level, according to their aptitude and propensity. And ultimately, as we grow and we assume at some point, I don't know when it will be, won't be in my lifetime, but sometime that when we have perhaps more influence and are running the country or whatever it may be, whatever will happen, this golden age of Kali Yuga, the government should establish Varnashram. And Varnashram needs to be established in a way that engages all of the citizens in activities which are meant for higher religious purposes, for regulated religious society, and ultimately for the spiritual advancement of everyone. But right now we're in a little bit of an awkward situation, where we are not quite at that position ourselves. So, but we need to be a little bit careful, I think, that sometimes in our desire to approach so many different people and to engage all classes of people and all kinds of people in Krishna consciousness, we also need to keep our own personal standard very high. And we need to keep those standards that Srila Prabhupada gave us and really have those in the forefront And those be the things that guide us and give us direction and really provide the answers. Sometimes when we are engaging in different types of preaching activities, different questions come up. Should we do this? Should we do that? Where do we sort of, I don't want to say bend the rules. It's not exactly that. But where do we make more and more allowances? And I think that, that it's really, in some ways it seems complex. In some ways it's very simple. In other words, we can be very liberal with others, and we should be very strict with ourselves. It's really quite simple. For those of us who are initiated devotees in this ISKCON society, we want to try to advance to the highest degree possible. We want to keep the standards very strict in Krishna consciousness and make sure that we are following Srila Prabhupada according to the rules, regulations, and standards that he gave. Others we can be more liberal with, and we just try to encourage people. We don't discourage people, and we don't try to artificially impose things that are beyond the ability of that person to receive. Because we actually have full faith that if one simply begins chanting Hare Krishna, begins reading these books, taking prasadam, then a purification process is beginning. And it will happen gradually, little by little, until people become more and more advanced in Krishna consciousness. No, but it seems like it's always a struggle in some ways for all of us to continue to have a fidelity to Srila Prabhupada and Srila Prabhupada's instructions and Srila Prabhupada's standards, and try to, at least within our temples, maintain those very highly and to the best of our ability. And because actually, when you think what attracted us to Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada came, I remember Srila Prabhupada, when I first was becoming a devotee, it was all the, you heard, I didn't see Srila Prabhupada for probably a year or two after I became a devotee, but, you heard all the stories of Srila Prabhupada. And it's like, and all those stories were always about Srila Prabhupada's renunciation, how he came from India with only $7 in his pocket. In other words, these were the types of things that attracted us to Srila Prabhupada. Not anything glittery, not that he was wealthy, not that he had done so. We only had a few temples. We were actually a fairly pretty poor society, as I remember when I came. There was like a handful of temples. And, it wasn't that that attracted us. It was the purity of Srila Prabhupada. It was the purity of his philosophy. It was the power of the philosophy and the power of the holy name. These things are what attracted us. And when I first met the devotees, I realized that these were people that were very special. These people were very advanced in spiritual life. That they were actually experiencing something that I wanted to experience. And I wanted to know, what was that secret, what was it? So it's really, now if they were all just kind of hanging out and like the rest of us hippies and acting like the rest of us, I wouldn't have been attracted. I would say, they're just another bunch of guys like us. What's the difference? Right? What attracts us is somebody who has purity, somebody who, and even if they're all very new, maybe they weren't so pure, but they were dedicated. They were pure in the sense that they were purely following. They were sincerely following Srila Prabhupada, sincerely following the practices of Krishna consciousness, and they were happy. And they were happy doing it. And these are the things that are going to attract people to Krishna consciousness. That we show that example. That we are practicing, that we are happy in that practice. And we have something very different to offer. That isn't just, another group, who happens to, like kirtan or something. We are much more than that. It is much deeper than that. And as people then get to know and understand, and as they become friends with the devotees, then they will also understand that we have this very, very deep philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita. That is just incomparable. And then the heart becomes completely attracted, becomes completely convinced, overwhelmed, and people will join this movement. So, it's probably end there. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Are there any other comments, questions? Premakanta, then Kirtan.
Albeit that you dress the larger picture, how would you suggest to the man animals how or why they shouldn't steer clear of this Varnashram and Vaishnavism that was spoken about in the verse this morning.
How should who stay clear? What?
For the man animals who were sacrificed, why we shouldn't steer clear of these, all of this.
Yeah, there's obviously there's some different customs here which are not things that we would endorse, and it seems a little bit unusual. Of course, there's a much longer explanation of that, I think, in the pastimes of Harishchandra, another part of the Bhagavatam. I didn't really get into that, but I mean, it does make a little more sense within the context. When you hear just one verse like that, it's just kind of like strange, sort of hits us kind of in an unusual way. But there is a greater context to it, and of course, as we can see, he was saved, and demigod saved him, and he becomes a great devotee too. So it was all, and again, these things are part of greater pastimes, and they have to really be seen within that context, you know. But in many ways, life is much simpler if you just take the Sankirtan Jagya of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and rather than worrying about different interesting ritualistic ceremonies, which are certainly not appropriate for us. Right. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I think we just have to see that it's part of a long story and a pastime, and obviously it was not recommended because the demigods save him and they prevent that from happening. You know. Kirikam?
Yeah, the fourth one was with Parshuram and Vishwamitra. If you remember, the mother of Vishwamitra and the mother-in-law, they had switched up payasa. So they were. So Vishwamitra was actually destined to take up Brahminical practice. You know, if you remember that story. So that was, and Parshuram was destined to take up Kshatriya practice. And the other point is with Vishwamitra and Shunashepa. What happened, Vishwamitra taught Shunashepa some mantras to pray to the demigods so he would be released from that human sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And so he did that, and he was forgiven for that. Mm-hmm. See? So in that way he was saved from the sacrifice. And then Vishwamitra adopted him as a son, because it stated there are five ways you can acquire a son. One is by natural birth, another is by adoption, another is by purchase, another is by like winning in a war or something, and there's one out of, you know, but there are five ways. So one of the way was he actually adopted Sunashepa as his son, because he saved his life.
Right. Good.
And the other point is,
yeah, I think that's the next couple of verses talk about that.
Yeah. The other point is, you see, because the Srimad Bhagavatam is, the stories and philosophy are all based on the Varnashram Dharma and Satyam. You know, it's not that you know, we're really pushing Varnashram Dharma, but because the whole setting of Srimad Bhagavatam is based on Varnashram literature. So, like, sometimes when we give class, we may explain the principles that This is how the Kshatriya operate, or the Brahmanas. It's not really that you know, we know that devotees are above Varnashram. I mean, it's a culture that helps to elevate oneself to Krishna consciousness, but it's not like a prerequisite or whatever. I mean, we can, you know, certainly we can do without it now, as Lord Chaitanya taught us.
And of course, one of the difficulties is that Varnashram is broken down completely in Kali Yuga. In former Yugas, it was in place, and it was a very, you know, it was a functioning system that really supported society and supported Krishna consciousness, you know, and that's what it's meant to be. And of course, now in Kali Yuga, as even Lord Chaitanya said, it's very difficult to reestablish or put it completely in place because of the nature of this age. Yeah,
times of the that we were just discussing, they're very difficult to understand everything, because you know they, ultimately they're all pastimes, eternal pastimes of Lord Krishna, and they're also in the material world. Sometimes we've seen that there's Prabhupada said that you know all these pastimes are there so that we can, for as an example, to show us, you know, how to, you know, do a particular activity or thing. But then, you know, it's not so important that we try to understand every aspect of every pastime that's going on, because it's more important to get the essence of that and to put it into the heart. And to understand what is the actual, you know, it's an example that's given for us for our own benefit. Not that we, you know, like we can, oh, like he did this power, and then you know what, can we get that power? Or how can you know every little? But yeah. To actually grasp the most important, like Prabhupada, he may be giving a whole lecture and everything, but then he sums it up in one, you know, at the essence of what he's trying to give you.
Yeah, I think
heart,
that, yeah.
Which is supposed to grow, and that's
yeah, I think
that
that's an important point. Yeah, that, and I think that's generally the way I approach the Bhagavatam, is that you know I may not understand all the intricacies of all of the, especially in the ninth canto here, of everything that's happening, but we try to get the essence. We try to get what is the meaning, what are the lessons, you know, what do we learn from this, you know, and to understand the philosophy. That's a good point. Okay, so I'll go to the Prabhupada.